glances around. Well, I'm the sheriff. If you guys are coming back, then that puts you under my jurisdiction. You're not the sheriff of Lake County, one of the guardsmen replied. No, I'm the sheriff of Eustace, the man replied.
The what?
Ian asked. The sheriff of Eustace. Things are going back to how they used to be. Ian looked back at the group of women at the fence. He the sheriff? The man claiming to be the sheriff looked over at them. His glance obviously unsettled them, and they shrank back from the fence. Yeah, he's the sheriff, one of them replied. Ian glanced back at the man and noted the look on his face, looking at the women. Then he asked, What makes you the sheriff?
Someone had to do it. Someone had to step in and try to make this place safer, so me and my boys did.
You got any experience in law enforcement? Ian asked.
He shrugged. Well, no, but all you need is common sense. It ain't hard to tell right from wrong.
So you just decided to make yourself sheriff? Ian asked.
He obviously caught the mocking tone.
Damn right I did. And I heard the address by the feds. They said the National Guard was supposed to put themselves under the jurisdiction of the local authorities. That's me.
Ian laughed.
Lawfully elected authorities, maybe. Not just some dude who's decided to make himself sheriff.
Well, I am the sheriff, the man said, his eyes narrowing.
Ian laughed.
I'm done with you, he said, turning his back on the men.
The sheriff was incredulous. He looked at his men.
You believe these idiots? Who the hell do they think they are?
One of the men replied, almost in a whisper,
The guys with the machine guns.
The sheriff sneered at him.
Yeah, well, when they come back, we'll be here.
We tried that once. We couldn't get in, another of the men replied.
Yeah, well, we will this time, the sheriff spat back.
While they spoke, Perez had returned to the trucks, and everyone loaded up. The trucks were started up and maneuvered to go back out the gate. Pulling up to the gate, Ian swung the saw around, pointing it at the four men.
Move! He shouted.
The four men backed up from the gate a short distance, and the trucks pulled through. Outside the gate, Ian ordered them to back farther away. They needed to secure the gate.
Back up!
Ian shouted. Begrudgingly, the four men started to back away. Ian watched them intently as they were all armed. The sheriff shifted the grip on the AK he carried. Ian caught the slight movement and shouted at him.
Don't even fucking think about it. I'll cut you fuckers in half.
The other three moved their hands to keep them in plain view. The sheriff, however, simply glared back. One of the other guys hopped out and secured the gate, then quickly got back in. Once back, Ian told Perez to take off. The two trucks moved out quickly, heading the wrong way down Bay Street. At the barricade, they didn't detour this time, driving straight to it. There were still men there, and he ordered them to push a car out of the way that acted as a gate in the center. The men hesitated for a moment. Ian stood up in the web seat of the turret and pointed at them.
Move that fucking car now, or I'll open up!
Two of the men quickly began moving the car out of the way. As they did, the gunner in the rear Hummer called over the radio.
They're closing in on us!
Ian looked back and could see the two ATVs closing quickly. Looking forward to make sure the car was nearly out of the way, Perez stomped on the gas and the Hummer started to roll. Seeing the big truck coming, the two men strained against the car, pushing it from the rear. As the Hummer closed in, they had to dive out of the way, and the right front corner of the bumper caught the car and slammed it into the ones in front of it. Now through the barricade, the truck sped up, putting distance between them and it. Ian looked back and could see the sheriff standing in front of it, hands on his hips, watching as the distance between them increased.
He's going to be a problem, Perez shouted over his shoulder.
Ian ducked his head down through the turret.
That's what he thinks, but he has no idea of the shitstorm heading his way.
Heading back toward the camp, they were staring directly into the smoke. It covered the entire horizon before them.
The rising smoke now had a mix of colors in it. White, black, yellow, and what almost looked like green.
"Holy Mary, Mother of God," Perez nearly whispered. "Look at it! That fire is massive!"
The guardsmen beside him looked over.
"It looks like the entire world is burning. We need to get the hell out of that forest, fast."
Perez could hear Ian on the radio relaying the situation at the armory back to the brass at the camp. It was just noise in his ears, though, as he was totally engrossed in the sight before him. There were more people now on the road, all of whom were looking to the north.
"Where are you now?" Sheffield asked over the radio.
"We're passing the orange juice plant in Umatilla," Ian replied.
"Find a place to pull off and wait. We've already got the first convoy of trucks heading out."
Perez pulled the Hummer into the grassy median. Ian thought about what was going on.
"Captain, we're probably going to have to deal with a self-proclaimed sheriff on the way back."
"A what?"
"Some guy claims to be sheriff of Eustace. Said we were supposed to be under his control."
After a long pause, Sheffield's voice came back over the radio.
"Stumpknocker will talk to him when he gets there, see what he's about."
Ian smiled, thinking of the old man. That poor bastard in Eustace had no idea the trouble headed his way. Ian turned in his turret and called out to the other gunner.
"Keep an eye out. We're going to wait here."
He gave a thumbs up in reply. Across the street was an old gas station sitting beside a small shopping plaza. Even in the before, the plaza was essentially defunct, but now it looked even more depressing and empty than ever. Despite that, a group of kids were playing in the parking lot. Ian smiled and waved at them, and then ducked down into the truck. Dragging a box of MREs over, he started pulling the meals out and opening them. He was looking for the candies that were inevitably in every meal. Once he had several packs of M&Ms and Skittles, he grabbed his carbine and got out.
"Hey!"
he shouted at the kids, waving them over. They came running over in a stampede. He started handing out small handfuls of candies to the kids. It soon turned into a mob scene, with the bigger kids pushing the smaller ones out of the way. Seeing one particular face for the second time, he said,
"You've had yours, beat it."
The kid's shoulders slumped, and Ian pushed through the crowd to the smaller ones in the back, making sure they got their share.
"Are you soldiers?"
a little girl in a filthy dress asked. She smiled, and he could see the plaque crusted on her teeth.
"Hell no. My parents are married. I'm a Marine,"
Ian replied with a big smile, not at all considering the audience he delivered the joke to.
"What are you doing?"
"Waiting for some of my friends."
One of the bigger kids, a boy, said,
"My dad says you guys are a bunch of cowards."
Ian made a show of looking at himself.
"Does it look to you like I'm afraid of anything?"
"Not to me. You look scary,"
the little girl shouted.
"Do you have any more candy?"
a boy of about 5 or 6 asked shyly. Ian held up his hands.
"Nope, it's all gone."
"I'm still hungry,"
another little one said. Ian was a tough guy, but hearing their little pleas got to him. After a tour in Iraq and 2 in Afghanistan, it was always kids he really felt for. They hadn't asked to be born into these wars. They had no control over which religious sect their family was part of, and inevitably, they were always caught in the middle. He'd arranged with his mom to send toys over. Soccer balls were popular. And she'd done a drive once and sent him over 2 dozen. He remembered the days when he'd give them out, a few at a time in each village. The smiles in their faces when they received something as simple as a ball was amazing. It gave them the chance to be kids again, even if just for a little while. And that was worth it. Back then, he had become popular with the kids, and many knew him on sight. Ian went back to the Hummer and took the case of meals out, setting it on the hood of the truck. He started taking the meals apart and pulling the individual foil packages out and opening them. The smaller, sickly-looking kids got the main entrees. The bigger, healthier ones ended up with side dishes. There weren't enough spoons to go around, but it didn't deter any of the kids. If they didn't get a spoon, they simply used their dirty fingers to scoop the food into their mouths. After ensuring each kid had something to eat, Ian sat back and watched them. Every one of them took what they were offered without complaint, a bit of a novelty with modern children. Once whatever was in the package was consumed, the kids would lick the inside, leaving no trace whatsoever of the original contents. When they finished, the kids simply dropped the remnants of the pouch where they stood. At first, this bothered him, but with the amount of trash already around, it made little difference. These kids no longer knew a world where trash was expected to be placed into a container, only to magically disappear. To them, the world was one large trash can. Invigorated with the nourishment, the kids started running around, screaming and shouting. Some were wrestling, as kids will do, while some version of tag seemed to be going on with the majority. As an afterthought, he started tossing them the packs of gum each MRE contained as well. And soon, all of them were smacking their gum as they ran and played. Perez stepped out of the truck. "Here they come!" Ian looked up the road to see a line of trucks and Hummers approaching. The column pulled up and stopped in the road beside him. Ian walked out to the lead Hummer that held Sarge, Ted, Mike, and Doc. "You guys ready to have some fun?" Ian asked. Sarge smiled. "Ah, this ain't gonna be nothing. I just can't wait for that old boy to tell you that you'll be working for him," Ian said with a laugh. "Oh, this is going to be rich," Mike said from the turret. "We ain't getting anywhere standing here chewing our cud. Let's get this goat rope on the road," Sarge said. Ian slapped the top of the Hummer and quickly returned to his truck, climbing back up into the turret. With so many trucks there, the kids stood with mouths open in awe, many waving at the guardsmen. Some of the guardsmen were tossing out items to them, bottles of water, whole MREs, and whatever else they could come up with. Seeing the kids in such bad shape clearly had affected them. Ian's two Hummers took the lead of the column as they pulled back out onto the road. "The roadblock is just up ahead. How do you want to handle it?" Ian called. "What's blocking the road?" Sarge asked. "Some cars. They've got one they roll out of the way like a gate. Just head for that car. If they don't want to move it, we will. We need clear access to the armory." "Roger that." Perez lined the truck up with the gate car as they approached. Just as previously, they could see the men behind the barricade peeking out from behind it. Ian kept his eyes on them as they drew near. Stopping short of it, he called out, "Move that car!" One of the men on the other side stuck his head up. "The sheriff told us not to let anyone through." "What's going on up there?" Sarge asked over the radio. "They don't want to open it. Whatever truck has the Mark 19 on it, pull up to the front." After a couple of minutes, a Hummer pulled up beside Ian. Then Sarge walked up with Ted and Doc in tow. He looked up at Ian. "Cover us. I'm going up there to have a talk with them." Ian nodded and shouldered the weapon as Sarge and the guys walked toward the line of cars blocking the road. Behind them, the men on the other side shared glances, unsure of what was going on. Stopping 20 or so feet away, Sarge called out, "Which one of you booger eaters in charge here?"
"The sheriff isn't here right now," came the reply.
"That's not what I asked. I asked which one of you idiots was in charge here."
One man rose up behind the cars.
"I guess I am."
"What's your name?"
Sarge asked.
"Mitch," the man called back.
"Well, Mitch, you need to move that car out of the way, or we will. If we do it, you won't be here to see it."
"Like I said, the sheriff said not to let anyone through."
"Mitch, you seem to be missing the point here. I'm not asking you, I'm telling you."
Sarge turned and pointed at the Mark 19.
"You see that thing up there?"
Mitch looked over at the weapon mounted to the top of the truck, then back at Sarge.
"You know what it is?"
Sarge asked.
Mitch shook his head. "It's a Mark 19 40-millimeter grenade launcher.
that can rain 325 of those nasty little bastards down on you in a minute. Now, if you don't move that car out of the way, Sarge pointed to the gunner behind the weapon, he will.
The man behind the barricade once again shared furtive glances. After a quick whispered exchange, the car began to roll back.
Smart man, Mitch, Sarge shouted.
Perez pulled through the barricade and off the side of the road, covering it from the rear. Ted ran back and brought their truck up, picking up Sarge and Doc. As they pulled through the barricade, Sarge motioned for Ted to stop and waved Mitch over.
Now, we're going to be coming back out in a bit. Over the next few days, we'll be making several more trips. We won't have to have this discussion again, will we?
I'm just doing what I'm told. I'll tell the sheriff.
Well, tell him to come see me.
Who are you?
Just tell him to ask for Sarge.
Mitch nodded, and Sarge waved Ted on.
The short drive to the armory occurred without incident, and all the trucks were soon inside the fenced yard behind the facility. Along with the mountain of supplies, the trucks carried a contingent of 20 guardsmen who would be left behind to provide security. Everyone got busy quickly to get the trucks unloaded, while Sarge went in to check out the hall, telling Ted to call the camp and let them know they had arrived. After looking the facility over, Sarge came out and found Ian.
Why don't you and Perez stay here? Keep your truck, too. Take control of this place and start getting things set up.
Ian nodded.
Sure thing. We've got to fix a cut in the fence back there. We'll get that done and get some security established.
Good deal. You've got enough food and water for a few days, but take it easy on it, just in case.
Will do.
All right. Let's get this circus back on the road, Sarge shouted.
After a little jockeying of trucks, they were all lined up in front of the armory. The activity was once again drawing a crowd of onlookers, though they kept their distance. Sarge walked the line of trucks, making sure everyone was ready. He still used the cane, but was relying on it less and less every day. Shouts from the rear of the column got his attention, and, turning around, he saw a couple of ATVs stopped at the rear. Word quickly spread down the column that a man claiming to be the sheriff was back there. Sarge walked back down the line to where a group of guardsmen were covering the men. Sarge walked straight to the men.
What can I do for you fellers?
I'm Sheriff Parker, a big man replied.
Well, I'm King George,
Sarge replied, getting a perplexed look from the man.
If we're making shit up, why not be king?
Sarge added.
The man's eyes narrowed.
I'm not making nothing up. I am the sheriff of Eustace.
Sarge crossed his arms.
Were you elected?
Well, no. Someone had to step up, so I did. We've made the town safer. It was rough around here for a while.
That's good. Good you're working to make the town safer. Back to my original question. What can I do for you?
Are you guys moving into the armory to stay?
The sheriff asked.
We are. There's a lot more coming, too.
Parker looked around.
Are you bringing in supplies for the town?
Sarge shook his head.
Not right now. We'll be able to support ourselves. Won't need anything from the folks here. But right now, we can't offer them any help either.
Parker licked his lips.
How many men are you bringing in?
Sarge smiled and rocked on his heels, not answering the question. Parker waited a moment for a response, then asked,
Where have you been?
We had to deal with some federal boys. Now that that's taken care of, we're coming back.
Parker kind of nodded his head.
Oh, okay. I was telling one of the guys that was here earlier that I heard a broadcast from the government that the National Guard was supposed to put themselves under control of the local authorities.
He paused for a moment, then continued, uncertainty clearly present in his voice.
And since I'm the sheriff, that makes me the local authority.
Sarge rocked back on his heels again and spit into the dust at his feet.
Well, Sheriff, it's like this. We're not going to be under your authority. We're under the authority of the Department of Defense,
and that's not going to change. But I'll tell you what. You take care of your town, and we won't get in your way. Sarge pointed at him. So long as you're doing the right thing, I catch you fucking up, and you'll be dealt with. Parker shook his head. Oh, no. I mean, we're just working for the town, trying to keep things safe and take care of everyone. Sarge nodded. That's good. You just keep doing that. The CEO of this place is Captain Sheffield. Once these guys are all moved in, he'll probably want to talk to you. Just give him some time to get settled in. You're not in charge here? Nah, not me, Sarge smiled. I don't have the people skills for that sort of thing. So I need to talk to the captain then? Parker said. You can talk to him. He'll probably want to. But don't expect anything different from him than I told you. You fellas have a good day. We gotta get on the road. Sarge squinted at Parker. We have to make several more trips this way. I know we won't have any more trouble at your roadblock, will we? Sarge said, the last being a statement, not a question. I'll let my deputies know to allow you through, Parker replied. Sarge nodded and waved as he headed back down the line of trucks. As he climbed up into the Hummer, Ted looked at him. Well? Sarge shook his head and clicked his tongue. I don't know. Hard to get a read on the fella. He may just be trying to help the town out, but his grand idea that he's going to take over this unit is fucking nuts. He shouldn't be too much of a problem, Ted replied, as he put the Hummer in gear and started down the road. You set him straight, Sarge. Word was spreading of the convoy's presence, and on the trip back, more people were out on the side of the road. From his perch in the turret, Mike watched the people as they passed, looking like something from an old film reel of World War II, the countless scenes of refugees lining the sides of the road as military vehicles passed. It was a profound image to Mike. During his multiple tours of service in the Middle East, the throngs of people lining the side of the road never bothered him, but here, in the country of his birth, the effect was different. A deep sense of sadness filled him as he watched these poor people in their filthy clothes, some of the children displaying the classic signs of malnutrition. The bloated bellies really brought it home. While Mike never was a religious man, though in his youth he'd attended Sunday school and Bible studies, a line of scripture came to him from the book of Samuel. How the mighty have fallen. He thought of all those months, years, spent trying to defend this same nation from those that craved this very result. What a waste, he thought. Quickly, he realized he was in a daze, not paying attention to the road about him, his hands hanging limply from the weapon. It is what it is. Deal with it, he thought, and focused his attention to the task at hand. The convoy made it back to camp without incident, and the loading of the trucks was begun again. Chapter 7. Back at the neighborhood, we spotted my girls as we drove in. Taylor, Leanne, and Little Bit were out hunting. Any luck? I asked as we pulled up. Not yet. The squirrels are getting smarter, Taylor said. Leanne was looking north. Dad, is that fire going to come here?
I don't know, baby, it might. We've got to get ready for it, just in case.
Fire scares me, Taylor said.
Don't be afraid yet, I said with a smile. You guys want to ride home?
No, we'll walk so we can look for squirrels, Taylor replied.
All right. When I get home, I'll lay the camo out. It'll help you blend in, and then maybe they'll come out.
Just take care of it, I said.
Okay, we will. Love you, Dad, Taylor shouted, her sisters quickly echoing her affection.
Danny leaned forward.
Hey, what about me?
Little Bit smiled.
We love you, too.
And Thad, Leanne said, catching me by surprise. Thad leaned out the window.
Love you girls, too. Thanks, Miss Leanne.
Yeah, Thad, too. We love you too, Thad, Little Bit shouted.
Thad smiled warmly.
I love you, girls. Good luck, he said,
waving at them. As we drove away, I looked at Thad in the rearview mirror.
Well, guess you're part of the family now.
Thad smiled again.
It feels good.
It touched me to see that Thad could be happy, despite what tragedy he had experienced. He truly had the warmest smile of any person I'd ever met, and I was glad my family got to count him as one of their own. Pulling up to Danny's, we went to the shed to look for sledgehammers, because on our quick stop at the forestry center, it was clear we were going to need a lot more manpower. Danny had two, so we loaded them up, along with some pry bars, bolt cutters, and a hacksaw.
You guys mind if I stay here? I want to work in the trailer, Danny said.
Fine by me. We'll get Jeff or Tyler to go with us, I said.
That's a good idea. Having them tanks on the trailer might come in right handy, Thad said.
Let's go see if there's anything for lunch and talk to the women folk real quick, I said.
Coming through the door, a wonderful aroma greeted us.
Damn! Thad shouted. What is that smell?
The house was full. Nearly everyone was there. Walking out on the back porch, I saw Edie and Jace out at the pond, wading in the shallow water.
We're making a stew, thanks to all of our veggies, Brandy replied with a smile.
The kerosene stove was set up on the picnic table on the back porch, a large kettle sitting on it. I lifted the lid on the pot. The smell was incredible.
Damn, this smells good, I said, inhaling the wonderful aroma again.
Where is the fire? Is it going to make it here? There's ash everywhere now, Bobby said.
It's north of Salt Springs, but it's moving fast, Danny said.
Moving this way? Mel asked.
I nodded.
It's moving south for sure. There's just no way to tell where it's going right now.
What are we going to do? Do we need to leave now? Brandy asked.
I don't think we need to leave, hon. We need to wait and see, Tyler reassured her.
Well, I for one don't want to get trapped by some giant-ass fire. I say if we're going to have to leave, I'd rather do it sooner than later, Jeff added.
Is there anything we can do about it? Fred asked.
We don't know yet. They're about to head back out to the Forestry Service place up at Pittman to see if we can get some firefighting equipment, Danny said.
Then, my mind changed gears. I looked around the room, scanning who was here, and asked,
Hey, who's on duty at the barricade?
Everyone looked around, but no one replied. I started for the front door, and just as I reached for the knob, it burst open. Taylor stumbled in, breathing heavily.
There's people down at our house.
My head snapped around.
What?
I asked, looking toward our house. Pointing, she said,
No, our old house. There's a bunch of people down there.
The house was suddenly filled with activity as everyone went for a weapon.
How many? Danny asked as he pulled the sling of his carbine over his head.
I don't know. There looked like a lot.
Where are your sisters? Mel asked, her voice tight.
They're coming. I just ran as fast as I could.
The other two made it to the house and came stumbling in as well. Little Bit was crying, obviously scared by the sight of the strangers. She went straight to Mel, who immediately bent down and gave her a hug.
Shh, shh, it's going to be all right.
You okay?
I asked Leanne as she tried to catch her breath. She nodded and asked,
What do they want?
We don't know, but we're about to find out.
Let's load up in the Suburban, I said, as I went out the door. All the guys followed me out, and everyone loaded up. Jeff and Tyler dropped the rear gate and sat on it. Pulling out of the gate, we could see an old truck sitting in the road down near my old place. As we got closer, I could see it was an old Grove truck, a common enough sight on the roads when oranges were in season. However, all that remained of this truck was the frame, a sheet steel bed, and the engine. The steering wheel seemed to sprout from the old relic, and a bucket was the only seat for the driver. The people obviously saw us coming, and soon there was a group of eight gathering around the truck, all armed.
Thad and Danny both had their doors open before the truck stopped, and Jeff and Tyler were already on the ground when I got out. The group stood around their truck with a collective look of defiance on their faces. They certainly had us outnumbered, but we had them outgunned. They carried a collection of arms, all of the hunting variety. I took in the scene, noticing that on the bed of the truck were a number of kids, all with dirty faces and dead eyes. This group is giving me a creepy vibe, like old dude in a van level creepy. Thad was first to speak.
What are you doing here?
An older man who appeared to be in his 60s stepped toward us. He had a shaggy gray beard and was wearing a cowboy hat that'd seen better days.
We're looking for a place to stay. The fire pushed us out of ours.
I'm sorry to hear that, Thad replied, looking in the direction of the encroaching smoke. But there's nowhere here for you to stay. The old man pointed at my house.
Why not? This one's empty.
I stepped up beside Thad. That's my house. I own it. I'm sorry you lost your place, but you can't stay here. One of the younger men stepped around the old man.
Why not? We need a place, and this isn't being used. If it's yours, why aren't you living there?
Doesn't matter why. I said no. I'm sorry for your hardship, but you folks need to be on your way, I replied.
That's fine, then. We'll just take one of the other empty houses here, the old man said.
That's not going to happen either. This is our neighborhood.
You just be on your way, Thad said.
You can't make us leave. Who do you think you are to tell us to leave?
How about you leave? One of the younger men spat back.
Look, there are plenty of abandoned places around. Lots of folks are gone. Just keep looking and you'll find one. There's no reason to make a big deal out of this. We're already here, and there aren't enough resources around here as it is. There's no water source you can use, and we're already hunting what game there is, and it isn't much, Danny said, using a reasonable tone.
Where are you getting water? The old man asked.
Doesn't matter. Just keep going a little farther toward Altoona, and you'll find plenty of places. And you, Matilla, there's a bunch of empty houses and two big lakes for water. The old man waved an arm toward the truck, where I noticed a group of young children huddled together.
We need a place for these young'uns. They need a safe place. That's all we're looking for.
Danny nodded. I can appreciate that, but the next town is just another couple of miles up the road.
I don't much take to being told what to do, the old man said as he rubbed his beard.
We're not telling you what to do, just what you can't do here, I said. The young man pointed at me.
You're a smart ass.
Danny whispered to me.
Chill out. They'll go.
One way or another, I shot back.
How many people you got here? The old man asked.
Enough, Thad replied.
Pointing at my truck, he asked,
You got any fuel to trade?
That's one thing we really don't have, I said.
Yeah, getting pretty scarce now.
The old man dug at his beard again and looked around.
I reckon we can go on down the road, he smiled. There's plenty of places no one owns.
The young man looked at him.
You're going to let them run us off? We got as much right to be here as they do.
He paused and looked at us.
And there's more of us than there is of them.
Now, Billy, this ain't the time for that.
Before I could say anything, Thad said,
And there won't be a time for it. It ain't worth it.
The old man looked back at him.
You reckon?
No, I know, Thad replied.
Billy, I think we'll go on down the road and find us a place with better neighbors.
Good luck to you, Thad said, as they began to load up in the truck.
The young man with the attitude sat on the open bed, giving us the stink eye until they pulled out onto the road and disappeared from view.
Damn, I thought I was about to go to shit, Tyler said, letting out a long breath.
I have a feeling this ain't over, Jeff said.
Who the hell was supposed to be on duty down here?
We can't let this kind of crap happen. We were lucky this time, I said.
And there can't be a second time, Danny added.
We really need to keep our eyes open. With the fire and the camp being released, I have a feeling we'll be seeing a lot more of this.
Everyone needs to be armed at all times now, too, Thad said.
How are we going to do all this? We need to go to the forestry place and see if there's anything there. We have these gabions to finish filling, so we have some sort of ballistic protection, and we have to keep watch here, Danny said, shaking his head.
We've got 8 more people down the road. Just remember that. Everyone's just going to have to pitch in more. We'll get Jess, Fred, and the girls to work on filling the gabions. Tyler and Jeff can take the first watch while we go see if we can get into the building. Just modify the board to show who's where, doing what, I said. When we got back to the house, Mel was on the couch with Little Bit, who was still upset. To our relief, they both had weapons on them. I reminded them to keep them close at all times now. Whoever was supposed to be on duty down there right now, and isn't, just allowed a truckload of people to drive right in here. We can't have this happen again. I know we just started this whole work schedule thing, but it's imperative that you know where you're supposed to be and be there without anyone telling you. We've got to work together here, all of us. Eric was sitting at the bar in the kitchen.
Sorry, Morgan. Me and Fred were supposed to be down there. It's my fault. Tyler had come down here to get me because we hadn't shown up. Then you guys came in and started talking about the fire. It won't happen again.
No one's perfect, and we're all going to screw up. Let's just take a lesson from this. Don't let it happen again.
I sat on the couch beside Little Bit and ran my hand through her hair.
You all right, kiddo?
She'd stopped crying, but stayed tight to Mel, nodding to my question.
Don't worry, sweetie. No one's going to hurt you.
When will you be back? She asked.
An hour or two. We won't be gone long.
Tyler and Jeff are at the end of the road. They're keeping an eye on things.
I gave Mel a quick kiss on the forehead. We'll be back.
It was a short drive to the Pittman Center, but it gave us a prime view of the looming disaster. As I slowed to turn into the compound, Danny pointed up the road.
Would you look at that? He said with a low whistle.
Up the road, we could see what looked like at least 50 people walking south.
The next few days are going to be damn difficult, I said. This fire is adding a whole new element to the shitstorm that is our situation.
You can say that again, Thad agreed.
We got out and unloaded the tools, feeling even more pressure to get inside and quickly. I grabbed a hammer and stepped up to the wall.
You guys are going to think I'm nuts, but...
I tapped the block wall a couple of feet from the door.
That sounds solid, probably poured, Danny said.
Stepping back and taking up a swinging stance, I replied,
Only one way to find out,
and swung the hammer with as much force as I could muster. The hammer struck with a dull thud. We all leaned in to inspect the damage.
Well, you knocked the paint off, Thad said, chuckling.
Hardy har har, I replied.
Step back. Let me show you how to swing this jack, Thad said, as he gripped the handle.
Thad brought the hammer in hard, slamming it into the block. This time, some small pieces fell from the impact. Thad stepped back and smiled.
Now that's how you swing a hammer.
Okay, but the block is soft. When you get to the concrete, it's going to be a different story, Danny said. Thad and I took up positions on either side and took turns striking the wall one after another. The cinder block gave way quickly. However, Danny was right about the concrete. It wasn't nearly as forgiving.
This is going to take some time, I said, wiping sweat from my forehead.
Sure is, but I think we can do it, Thad said.
Danny took the hammer from my hand.
Let me take a swing at it.
We stepped back, and Danny went to work. After he took a few swings, a round robin of sorts commenced, with each of us taking a turn working on it.
We were concentrating on one block, trying to get it knocked all the way down. It took nearly an hour, but we finally broke through. It wasn't a big hole, but it was large enough to shine a light through and see if this was simply an exercise in frustration. Kneeling down, I pulled my flashlight out and clicked it on, shining it at the hole.
"Anything in there?" Thad asked.
I stood up and handed him the flashlight.
"Take a look for yourself."
Thad knelt down.
"Damn! Look at all that stuff."
"What's in there?" Danny asked.
"Pumps, hoses, drip torches, Pulaskis, brush axes. I see some gas cans. Maybe there's fuel," Thad replied.
"You see the chainsaws?" I asked. Thad's head bobbed around the hole.
"Yeah, there's a lot in here."
He stood up and handed me the light back.
"We need to get in there. This could be the key to stopping this fire."
"You know how long it's going to take to make a hole big enough to get through there?" Danny asked, clearly exasperated from all of our efforts. I fished around in the pocket of my vest that held my small survival kit.
"Maybe we don't have to," I said. "Prepper Morgan strikes again," Thad said. "What do you have in mind?"
Removing a small signal mirror and duct tape wrapped around a pencil stub, I went out under the trees and found a stick. Using the tape, I secured the mirror to the stick and knelt down with the flashlight again. Poking the stick through the hole, I shined the light onto it and moved the mirror around until I found what I was looking for. If we can find a piece of wire, we may be able to catch the doorknob. It's the handle type. Maybe we can hook it and open it. "Anything is worth a try right now," Danny said. "Let me see if I can find some wire."
"I'll work on making this hole a little bigger, give you more room to work," Thad said as he hefted the sledge again.
Danny and I went out behind the building to see what we could find, splitting up in different directions. Along the perimeter of the property, a large pine tree had fallen and taken some of the fence down with it. I climbed up on the massive trunk. It was a huge longleaf pine and was as big around as a 55-gallon drum. As I straddled it, something caught my eye. Tension wire from the top of the downed fence. There was a section about 5 or 6 feet long lying tangled in the tree.
"Hey, Danny! Go get that hacksaw," I shouted.
He trotted off toward the truck and came running back with the saw.
"What do you got?"
I'd freed most of the wire and held the loose end up.
"I think this will work." "Woo boy! Now that's what I'm talking about. Hold it while I cut it."
With the wire in hand, we returned to Thad, who'd made considerable progress on the hole. It was now about the size of a 5-gallon bucket. We fashioned a loop in the end of the wire and fed it through the hole. Danny knelt down and tried to hold the mirror while I worked the wire, but it just wasn't happening.
"Damn it! I don't think I can get it," I said, standing up.
Danny took the wire. "Let me try something." He put the wire through the hole and stuck his right arm through, then his head.
"Hand me your light," he said, sticking his left hand in the air.
I handed him the light. Pulling his head out, he stuck the light in his mouth, then poked his head back in. We could hear the wire scraping the door, then the floor, then the door again. I looked over at Thad and muttered,
"I don't think we're going to get it."
Thad nodded his head, agreeing. The scraping stopped. Then Danny's muffled shout.
"Fort!"
"What?" Thad asked.
"Fort! Fort!"
"I think he's saying pull it," I said. The only problem was the knob on our side was gone. Thinking quickly, Thad pulled out his knife and stuck it between the frame and door and pried the door open. Danny wriggled out of the hole and let out a loud breath. Thad stepped in as light poured into the small storage room.
"Look at all this," he said. "We've struck a gold mine." "We sure have. Now let's hope it's the type of gold mine that can stop a fire," I said.
"What are we going to take?" Danny asked. Thad and I looked at one another and replied in unison, "All of it." We busted out laughing. We went to work on bringing everything out. It was an impressive amount of gear. 2-inch gas-powered pumps, miles of hose and nozzles, drip torches, bunker gear, 4 full 5-gallon DOT gas cans, 3 blue DOT cans full of mixed fuel for the drip torches, and probably my favorite part of our haul, flare guns. By the time we got everything loaded, it was coming on to dark, so we hustled to get back. I realized that while we worked, the people we saw on the road may have walked past, which made me nervous. I didn't want our group to encounter more characters like the ones we had met earlier this afternoon. As we got closer to the house, we could see a large group farther south of our development. I exhaled a breath of relief that they had walked by, and hoped that would be the last large group for a while. Though, obviously, with the fire looming, that possibility seemed dim. Rolling up to the barricade, I stopped.
"Sup, ladies?"
I asked with a smile.
"Whatever, Haywood," Jeff replied.
Thad leaned over. "That group give you guys any trouble?" Tyler shook his head. "Nah. One of them came up and talked to us for a minute, asking about water. Other than that, though, they didn't ask for anything. Said they're running from the fire and told us we should get moving, too."
"That's good. See why we're doing this now? Why we have to keep someone here at all times?" I asked.
Jeff and Tyler nodded. "As for the fire, let's see what we can do about that, too."
"What'd you get?" Jeff asked.
Thad stuck his big head in my face again, jutting a thumb over his shoulder.
"Take a look for yourself."
Jeff and Tyler checked out the rear of the truck.
"Look at all that stuff!" Tyler exclaimed.
"Yeah, we got a little bit," Danny replied, grinning.
Pointing to the Gabians, I asked, "How'd the girls do?" "They got one of them filled. It was rough, though. They were pretty beat by the time they finished, but they wanted to complete one of them," Tyler said.
"Well, we'll have to get back to them tomorrow," I replied, and waved out the window as we drove off.
Back at Danny's, we decided to leave the gear in the truck, as we were all starving. The stew from hours ago was calling my name. Jess, Fred, and Eric got up from the table they were sitting at.
"Here, you guys sit and eat," Eric said.
The three of us sat down, and Mel brought bowls over to us. It was hard to tell exactly what was in the stew, but it was good. Hell, anything would be good at that moment. Blowing on a hot spoonful, I said, "Hey, good job on getting that basket filled."
"Oh my God, Dad, that was so hard," Taylor said.
"I bet," I smiled, taking a bite.
"You have no idea, Dad. My hands have blisters," Leanne said, looking at her palms.
I laughed. "More than you know, kiddo. When you guys were really little, I did more than my fair share of ditch digging." I held out one of my hands.
"Don't worry. Those blisters will turn into calluses soon enough."
"Ew, I don't want calluses,"
Leanne shouted.
"Yeah, that's rough work.
I think it would be better to do it in the morning or late afternoon. The middle of the day is brutal," Eric said.
Danny looked up and smiled. "Well, it's only going to get worse."
"Speaking of getting worse, it's getting hard to breathe out here," Brandy said.
"Yeah, there's so much smoke in the air," Leanne added.
"What were you guys able to find?" Mel asked. I detailed what we had brought back, and though impressed, I could see doubt in her eyes.
"Is that even going to help?"
I laughed.
"Let me just put it this way. Even before things went south, they'd have had a hell of a time putting this one out."
"Well, shit! What are we going to do?" Mel asked.
You could tell that she was stressed simply from the fact that she cursed.
"Well, that's what we need to figure out."
"I don't know crap about firefighting. Anyone else?" Eric asked. A little theory mostly, but Mike, one of Sarge's guys, said he fought wildfires for a couple of summers after high school, I said. I figured we could set the trailer up with those tanks and use the pumps we found. Essentially, use it as a fire truck, Danny said. Those Striker pumps will help, but they'll be about as effective as pissing into hell trying to fight the blaze. They'll be used for hot spots, or if ash sets other smaller fires around here.
Then what the heck are we going to do? We're going to have to leave again, Bobby said, panic in her voice.
Leanne moaned.
Aw, I don't want to leave again.
Taylor looked at me with wide eyes.
Dad, are we really going to have to go? Is there anything we can do?
The only thing I can think of is to set another fire, I said between bites. Everyone looked at me like I was crazy.
What? Are you nuts? Eric asked.
It's called a backburn. We'll wait until it gets closer and then light a fire in front of it. If all goes as planned, that fire will burn toward the other one and use up all the fuel. When the two meet, the blaze should stop moving in that direction.
What's to keep it from moving this way? Mel asked.
Well, what I'm thinking is to start the fire at 485, the road to Alexander Springs. The road will be a barricade this way, and the fire we'll light will be small, so it's not likely to jump the road. On the east, hopefully, the run will be a barricade there, and it'll just burn down into a pocket with no way out.
Danny was nodding.
That's a good idea. With the trailer, we can use it for any place it does jump.
Do we have enough people for this? Thad asked.
I shook my head.
No,
but Mike has some knowledge as well as Jamie. I think we can get their help.
Will that really work, the backfire? Mary asked.
It's our only shot.
Well, that or run, I said.
I'm not running unless I have to. I'm done running, Danny replied.
Tomorrow we'll get a hold of Sarge and see what he thinks. Right now, though, we need to get Jeff and Tyler off the barricade, I said, standing up from the table.
You guys have worked pretty hard today, I said to Jess and Fred, and then looked at my girls.
You too. Guess it's me and you, Danny.
You guys go for 4 hours or so, and then my shift starts, Thad said. And I'm with... He trailed off as he ran his finger down the list. Eric.
You feel up for it? Fred asked Eric.
He nodded. We just need to change the bandages. I'll be good.
Fred looked over at me.
Morgan, I hate to bring up another problem, but we're almost out of the bandages Doc gave us. Do you have anything we can use?
Chewing on a mouthful, I thought about it for a moment. Then Thad stepped in and answered.
Reuse what you have. Boil the old ones and let them dry, then reuse them.
Fred wrinkled her nose. That's kind of gross.
You got a better idea? I asked.
I've heard you can use maxi pads as dressings, Eric said, getting a laugh out of Leanne and Taylor.
I snickered.
Have you seen the number of women around here? We need all of those we can get.
All right, boiling and betadine it is, Fred said.
How's the wound looking, anyway?
Thad asked.
Doc told us what infection would look like, and I don't think there is any. It's not red around the edges or anything, Eric replied.
Good. Let's hope it stays that way.
Looking at Danny, I said, Let me get my NVGs, and we'll head down the road.
Mel stood up.
All right, girls, time to go.
She went to the screen door and called out,
Ashley! It's time to go.
Aw, come on. Can't we stay longer?
They'll be here tomorrow. Let's go.
Reluctantly, she came trotting up the hill, Jace and Edie hot on her heels. I thanked the ladies for dinner, and we left. Walking back to the house, Mel was holding my hand. Little Bit had the other.
Daddy, is that fire going to burn our house down?
Little Bit asked.
I hope not, baby. We're going to try and stop it.
I hope we can. I like it here. I don't want to leave again, she replied.
Me too, monkey. Me too.
As the older girls ran in the house, shouting something about playing Scrabble, I went in and found the NVGs. Grabbing a canteen, I filled it from the Berkey and stuck it in a pouch on the back of the vest.
How long are you going to be gone? Mel asked.
Few hours. I'll just be at the end of the road, though.
I know. I just don't like it when you're not here at night.
I wrapped my arms around her.
Me too. Can't sleep unless you're around nowadays.
She smiled and gave me a kiss.
Love you.
Love you too. I'll be back in a bit, I said, and walked back over to Danny's. We took two of the four-wheelers and rode down to the barricade. The smoke was getting heavier, as was the ash, falling like light snow. Jeff and Tyler were happy to see us, and even happier to see the food we brought.
See anything? Danny asked.
Few people came by. They looked pitiful.
Remember the people we used to see walking the road, you know, in the beginning? Jeff asked.
I nodded.
Worse than that.
A group came by earlier with a wagon that only had three wheels. I felt so bad for them. Just a look of utter defeat on their faces, Tyler said.
I can understand. Think about it. They've made it this far and probably had some sort of life reestablished, and now it's all going to be burned up, Danny said.
I hope that doesn't happen to us, Jeff said. I've grown to really like it here.
I smiled.
Yeah, we're like mold. We'll grow on you.
Jeff laughed. You're an idiot. They got on the four-wheelers and headed down the road. Danny and I went out to the barricade and leaned on the top log.
Like deja vu, Danny said.
Yeah, the more things change, the more they seem to stay the same. We watched as the sun began to drop for the horizon. The smoke acted as a filter and gave it a strange, ominous look, like a large red ball kissing the horizon. As soon as the sun dipped from view, the skeeters emerged with a vengeance.
Holy shit! These things are thick, I said, slapping the back of my neck.
This'll help, Danny said with a grin. He pulled a can of off out of his vest, and my eyes just about rolled out of my head.
Oh, thank the Lord! How much of that do you have?
Couple of cans, not much, Danny replied, as he began spraying his arms. With the sun finally down, I walked out into the road and looked north. Just above the horizon, the fire seemed to flicker and dance, changing colors as it did. Danny walked out, and we stood there in silence for a moment.
Man, that looks like it could burn the entire world, Danny said.
I guess it'll stop about Key West, I said with a snort.
You really think the backfire plan will work?
In theory, that's all I can say.
I hope your theory proves right.
Me too, man.
Hey, look at the bright side. Hurricane season's going to start soon. That'll put the fire out for sure.
Danny laughed. Oh yeah, that makes it better. We stood in the road for a long time watching the glow. As it got darker, the sinister glow got brighter, extending as far to both sides as we could see. I pictured a map of Florida in my mind, trying to think of what was out there. If it went too far to the west, it could potentially hit Ocala. All the pasture land surrounding it on the west side might slow it, and the city was pretty spread out and would probably be spared. But there were countless little towns scattered all over the forest that would surely be burned to the ground. Between us and the blaze was nothing but forest at this point. This thing looked like it was hundreds of square miles. If we managed to stop it from burning through here, to turn it with the back burn, the fire would burn all the way down to the St. John's and destroy countless more lives. As awful as it sounded, though, I knew I couldn't worry about those lives. I just wanted to protect the ones here. If it didn't jump the river, it would burn itself out, and if it did, DeLand would be the next to go, and we wouldn't be too far behind. Thinking about the cities that would be affected, DeBerry popped into my head.
Mom and Dad lived there.
Their place was down on the river, the other side, thankfully. I had no idea if they were still there,
or even still alive, for that matter. I wished I could go find out, but the trip by truck would probably be impossible. I could make it via the St. John's, going down the Alexander Run, to where it dumped into the big, backward-flowing river, but that would take days, and I had no idea what the river was like. Surely there were a lot of people roaming it. I just had to put faith in the fact that they were surviving just as we were. And if I knew my parents, they were probably even better off than I was. My dad was a tough guy, even more prepared than me. The thought brought a smile to my face. I could just see him in his kayak out on the river fishing. He loved to fish, and even being forced to do it out of need would never dampen his enthusiasm for the sport. Danny wandered back over to the barricade, and I followed him. It was full-on dark now, the skeeters testing the limits of the off. I climbed up on the barricade and sat on the top log. Danny came up beside me, and we sat there in the silence. Even though it had been months now, the silence of this new era always struck me. The night was so quiet. The days were too, for that matter. But after the sun went down, it took on another level. With no man-made sound, the world was a very quiet place. From time to time, I would take the NVGs out and scan the road. Toward the end of our shift, we heard some shouts. Both of us dropped off the log and jogged out into the road. The shouts were far off to the north, and while we couldn't make out the words, it sounded angry. A single gunshot rang out, followed by the piercing scream of a woman. The shouting stopped, but the wails of the woman continued.
"Somebody's having a bad day," Danny said.
"Sounds like it," I said, as I looked through the NVGs.
"See anything?"
"No. There's what might be a small fire, but it's way up there." We walked across the road and sat in the grass. Using the goggles, I looked up at the stars. The smoke in the air blocked out a number of them, but there was still an amazing variety to see. Looking at the Big Dipper, movement caught my eye. It looked like a star was slowly moving across the sky.
"I see a satellite," I said.
"No shit, where?" Danny asked, grabbing for my goggles. I handed them over. "Over there. Look at the end of the Big Dipper." Danny held them up and searched the sky for a moment.
"I see it. Hauling ass, isn't it?"
"Yeah. Wonder what kind it is."
"I wonder who it belongs to," Danny quipped.
He scanned the sky again for a bit. "Remember that night we saw the space station?"
"Yeah. Wonder if it's still up there."
"If it is, I feel for the poor bastards who are on it."
"Man, that would suck.
Run out of O2, or maybe food and water," I said, shaking my head.
"I guess they have an escape pod or something."
"Yeah, coming down in the middle of the ocean would sure suck, though." Danny grunted.
"Be better than being stuck in space."
I laughed.
"Got a point there."
Danny dropped the goggles, looking down the road.
"People."
I leaned forward to look down the road.
"Where?"
"Walking right down the middle of the road," he replied, handing me the goggles. Sure enough, there was a couple walking down the road. They didn't appear to have much with them, no wagon or cart, as was the norm with passing refugees. I couldn't even see a pack on them.
"What do you want to do?" I asked.
"Let's sit here. Maybe they'll just walk by." I dropped down, propping myself up on an elbow, and stared into the darkness. Every now and then, I would raise the goggles and see where they were.
"They're getting pretty close," I said.
"Yeah, I can hear them talking," Danny replied in a whisper. We sat quietly as the pair drew near. Soon, they were close enough that we could actually make out what they were saying.
"Should have just given it up," a man's voice said.
"You didn't have to shoot him," a woman replied angrily. "It's not like I had a choice. You should have just given it up." "He had children," she practically shouted.
He wasn't dead. He was still alive when we left. And we can eat tonight.
Danny looked over at me, eyebrows raised. I knew he was thinking the same thing I was, whether or not we should do something. But without knowing exactly what had happened, it didn't seem worth interfering. The two continued to talk as they approached. The woman asked where they were going to sleep for the night.
I don't know. Let's get some distance behind us.
As they were passing our little road, the woman asked,
What about here?
Let's just go find a house and sleep there. Not like they'll come looking in all the houses. The two stopped and looked around.
I don't know. I'd rather get farther down the road, the man said nervously.
But I'm tired. My feet hurt. We've been walking all day. It's not my fault you lost your damn mind.
You need to keep